is magnificent, is it not? This is why we work. This is why we create such things. You are familiar with the outward spectacle of public monuments, but until tonight, you have not seen such beauty, available to only a few. To produce such a masterpiece requires grand ideas, unswerving commitment to the dream, years of sweat and pain, and the firm loyalty of a wealthy patron. Such beauty does not come cheaply. But it added a layer of humanity that further captured my attention. And at some point I said to myself, sooner or later I'm going to have to put my own stamp on this story.
Hello, and welcome to History Through Fiction, the podcast. I'm your host, Colin Mustful, and today I am delighted to be joined by Brock Meyer, author of the novel, The Stonecutter.
So at the end of 6 months, I had written a 128,000-word novel. I was not intending to write that. I never had any interest in writing a novel.
After a half-century career of scientific research in infrared, lasers, and human vision, Brock Meyer now devotes himself to finding the incredible, untold stories of little-known people from centuries past. Written, cultural, and material history are the springboard from which he imagines engaging and powerful new stories for today. Come with him on his journeys as his stories begin where the history ends. Today, I'll be talking to Brock about his debut novel, The Stonecutter. I wonder if you could start with your tagline, stories begin where the history ends. What do you mean by that?
I've always kind of had an interest in different portions of history. And when you start looking into a lot of the details of that, you find out that there are people that don't really get all the headlines, heads of state, generals, things like that. But there are a lot of small people that crop up here and there that really intrigue me because they're regular people like your listeners and like myself, and they have fascinating stories. So that's really what it has to do with. All the big names get most of the history, but there's a lot of story to be told beyond that.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's what your novel here highlights. So tell me more about the novel, The Stonecutter. I'm specifically interested in the Nabatean Kingdom. If I knew about it, I didn't remember anything about it. So what is the kingdom and how did you come across this history and decide you wanted to write about it?
Well, I didn't really know anything about it either. This has not been a long-term interest of mine. Up until about 5 years ago when I first started looking into it, the most I knew about the Nabatean Kingdom was those scenes in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, where you see a few scenes of Petra, which was the capital of Nabatea. They called it Rachmu, but the Romans and we call it Petra. And the more I started looking into it, it's just a fascinating culture and group of people. It's kind of a paradox because, as it turns out, they were a highly literate people and yet left no records, no archives, no writings of any kind other than stone inscriptions in their tombs and temples. So most of what we know about them comes through historians of the time or diplomats, people that went to that area or maybe heard things secondhand about them. But we don't really have first-person views of what it was like to be in Nabatea.
Well, I want to ask you more about that history, but before we get into that, let's talk about the first-person view that you created with your main character, Nahor. Who is he, and how did you kind of create him?
I didn't actually create the man. I created my fictional view of his life. But he actually is a real man that lived in the first century. There is a very brief account in what are called the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It's a very brief story about a man who was demon-possessed, and so the demons that were in him said there were 1,000 of them, which is a pretty intriguing thing. He was rescued on the eastern shore of Lake Galilee, the demons having been cast out of him. So that's the account. It probably takes place over, at most, an hour or two of a real time. And that's all we know about him from the written record. The story fascinated me. I don't know why. I've never been demon-possessed. However, there was something about the man that just really captured my attention and I kind of identified with. So I've thought about that for many, many years. And probably 20 or so years ago, I heard a song by a man named Bob Bennett where he fictionalized that story and made it, he kind of added human depth to this man's life. And the song is probably 6 minutes or so long. So he didn't go into it in depth either. But it added a layer of humanity that further captured my attention. And at some point I said to myself, sooner or later I'm going to have to put my own stamp on this story. So here about 5 years ago, I was winding down my 50-year career as a research scientist and engineer, and I started writing seriously. And pretty early on, I realized I really needed to write about this man's life. So that's where the Nabatean kingdom, it doesn't say in the original account that he was a Nabatean, but it occurred on the eastern shore of Lake Galilee. And east of there and down south of there is all of what could be called the Nabatean kingdom. So I just said to myself, maybe this guy was a Nabatean. So that was where I first started thinking, well, I don't know anything about the Nabatean kingdom. So I started researching from that point.
Well, talk more then about how you were able to, you know, extrapolate his life from there, from that small account into an entire story revolving around him.
That's a really good question. I'm pretty much a seat-of-the-pants writer. You might think that with my previous career as a scientist and engineer, I'd be very analytical about this, and I would plot and plan this all out, but that's not really how I write fiction. I'm very much just sailing on into it. So pretty much how I did it was just to spend countless hours of researching. Most of that was the brief historical accounts that were given by foreigners at that time. That isn't very much. Then I spent loads of time looking at the archaeology that's been done over the past, most of it in the past 20 to 30 years. And really amazing stuff has been learned about that culture from the material culture that was left behind. So piecing all that together, finding out what these guys ate and what the city of Petra actually looked like at the time, and that was just incredible to realize. It was like Las Vegas today. You know, you drive hours and hours, if you don't fly there, you drive hours and hours through the desert. Finally, you get to this place and it's like, holy cow, where did this city spring up in this desert? this is like nowhere. There's nothing here but this incredible city. And Petra at that time was pretty much like that. People traveled on camels, diplomats, merchants, things like that, to go to Petra and either make political deals or to make economic trade deals. So they'd be on the back of a camel for weeks on end, going through an arid, trackless desert, and they'd get into the valley of Petra, and it would open up in a place that had public botanical gardens, public pools that were probably swimming pools, artificial waterfalls, fountains, things of that sort. Today we just see ruins, and those are pretty spectacular, but they're just a bare hint of what that city was originally like. So just trying to read about all of that and let that ferment in the back of my mind, then I just took the story and thought, who was this guy and how did he get to the point of being so incredibly demon-possessed? And then what happened to this guy after that? He was a real man with real ambition and desires in life, and to be end up demon possessed, where it talks about in the original account that he came to the point of cutting himself with sharp stones. That is a severe mental illness that you have to deal with. He was tormented in unimaginable ways. So what were the things in his real life that took him to that point? How did he end up there? So I just tried to add humanity, add a face and a voice to a guy that in the brief account doesn't have much.
Well, there's a couple things I want to ask about, what you just covered. First, have you had a chance to travel to Petra?
No, I haven't. A lot of people have asked me that, and I kind of feel like I've been there. I've looked at so many maps and archaeological studies of it. I know an amazing amount of details that is available. You can go online and kind of walk around there. You're not really there. I really would like to go there. A close friend of mine, he and his wife plan on going next year. So I said, hey, maybe I'll end up going with you. So that may be in plans for next year.
Well, for those listening, can you kind of describe a little bit the unique rock cut architecture that it's known for?
Yes, you may have seen pictures of it. Some of the tombs that have been carved, they're not built at all. They're not built from stone. They are carved out of a solid rock, mountain or cliff, depends on where it was. So it's a solid monolithic thing that is just carved using stone iron carving tools from the top down and from the front back in. So it's all one piece. It's as if you would take something yourself and carve it out of a solid block of stone. What they used them for was they're generally two-part things. There's a front anteroom, which is actually a banquet room. A large part of their culture revolved around what they called marzeas, which is a banquet that they held twice a year to honor their ancestors that had gone on before them and accomplished great things and all that. So they would invite all the main family members, people outside of the family that were important people. They'd have a banquet to celebrate their family. Then in the back room is where all the bodies were buried. So they'd have a celebration in the tomb there. And they were very elaborately decorated. What we see today is just the naked eroded stone. But in original Petra at that time, they were very smoothly coated with plaster, then painted generally with horizontal bands of bright colors. white, bright yellow, bright blues, things of that sort. So what we see is very different than what they saw. Also what we see is it's all desert-like. And at that time, they had totally figured out how to not only survive in an annual rainfall of about 2 or 3 inches a year, but to thrive and to make an incredible environment out of that. They had amazing agriculture. They grew vineyards and produced wine that was exported from there. As I mentioned, they had botanical gardens, things of that sort, all these fountains around. So what we see is a very stark sort of view. It was really originally a very elaborate, extravagant experience.
You mentioned that a couple of times now, that this Nahor was possessed by demons and he kind of goes on a spiritual journey. Can you talk a little bit about how you were able to discover the type of spirituality that would have been in his life and kind of how you were able to share that journey?
Yeah, that's a really pretty interesting thing too, is that the Nabataean kingdom was at a very unique, absolutely unique place on the face of the earth. It's the single place where three continents are joined together at one place. So because of that, there was incredible trade opportunities. Trade came through there from China and the Far East, also India. All that was traveling to the west, to the Mediterranean basin. It had to go through the Nabataean kingdom. There was also a lot of trade goods that came up from Africa to the Far East and to Europe. There's also stuff that came from Europe, from the west and the north to the east. So all this trade is going back and forth. Also, because of its unique location, there's a lot of political and military struggle over that location because everybody wants to control trade and money and power and influence. Then because of all these people being interested in that one place and coming together in the same place, then you have different ideas coming, different technologies, different philosophies, different religions. So the Nabataeans themselves had their own pantheon. Their main religion in Rakmu, they had kind of a, I'll call it a trinity. They had two main goddesses and one god that they really were devoted to. But you also find in some of the outskirts of Petra, other gods and goddesses being worshipped on a small-term basis, probably by some of the other people that came to live there that were foreigners, but they lived there because of the trade opportunities. So they brought their own gods with them. So that was starting to creep into the culture. So part of what I came up with in writing about this young man and his mentor, who was also a sculptor who trained him in the art and kind of was his father figure, they kind of struggled back and forth about these old ideas that came from the past, their ancestors, and what about all these other gods? Well, in the written record of this man's life, he encounters Yeshua, who we call Jesus, on the eastern shore of Galilee. Jesus casts out this man's demons. And so his life has changed in a dramatic way. So what did that do in his life? Now this whole new monkey wrench is thrown into the whole thing. And what do you do with that? So he finds a very difficult life after that because he tries to still live within his original culture, but now he's coming from a totally different place. And how do you handle that?
Well, we've covered a lot of the history now and a lot about your character here and how you were able to humanize him and bring him to life. But let's talk a little bit about you and your background. You talked about a career transition you had. So what did you do before you became a writer, and what was that transition like for you? Why did you transition to becoming a writer?
For about 50 years, I worked in, I'll call it research science and engineering. My degree is in engineering, but a lot of what I actually did was a lot of basic science. So that was, over those 50 years, covered infrared science and engineering, laser technology, and for the last 20 to 25 years, I was involved quite heavily in the research of human vision and how it relates to laser exposure. So a lot of that was, for my part, was involved in being in laboratories where, for the most part, I was setting up, designing and setting up optical. I could tell you some of the details of this, but if I did, I'd have to shoot you, as the cliche goes. But a lot of it involves setting up optical systems for the purpose of doing experiments. So I was pretty much an experimentalist scientist, and I worked a lot with people who are more from the theoretical side. So they would say, well, in order to test this theory, this idea, we need to find this out. So this is the experiment we want to run. So I would then figure out how to set up those experiments. So I did that first in Santa Barbara for about 10 years. And then I moved to Texas, where I now live. And I worked for three different companies that did different things related to that. So at the end of that period of time, I really loved my job. Every day was unique. I never knew exactly what I was going to expect. The nice thing about research is you can never lose. You never really make a mistake. You have an idea of what you want to do, and you go in and you work at it for a couple of weeks, or maybe 6 months, maybe 2 years. And at the end, it didn't work. But hey, that's research. That's the game. And if it actually turns out to all work out, well, hey, you're ahead of the game. So you never knew what was going to happen, and that was a pretty exciting thing. I really enjoyed that. But at the end of that time, there were stories that I knew were deeply inside of me, and I've for a long time wanted to see what would happen with that. So after the end of 50 years, I kind of worked myself out of a job. I had a lot of flexibility in what I did. So over about a 3-year period, I went from a 5-day work week to a 4-day to a 3-day to a 1-day. And then eventually at the end, it was 1 day out of a month. So I kind of slowly but surely went from being a research scientist to becoming an author.
And how challenging has that been? I mean, obviously, when you become a writer, you have certain expectations built up, but no one really knows how that process is like until you go through it. So what has the process been like for you? What have been some of the challenges and the rewards?
Well, here's kind of a funny thing. This is probably most of the authors that you talk with, they probably say something like, well, I knew that I wanted to be an author from fifth grade. You know, when I heard my first story, or my parents read to me, or I could first learn to write, I knew I wanted to be an author. Well, that wasn't me. I never even, in fact, wanted to write a novel. This is a whole much longer story, but in brief, I was kind of hoodwinked, or I was kind of dragged screaming and kicking into the ranks of being an author. And I guess briefly I can say that a fellow author and poet wrote a poem that I had read at one point, and that poem so captured my attention that I just couldn't get it out of my mind. And the only way that I thought I might be able to get rid of it was to write about it, so I did. And what I wrote was not anything like a novel, but I sent it off to her and I said, look what you made me do. And she said, oh, well, this is great that my writing inspired some creativity in somebody else. That's great. And I thought I was done with it. But I found out a few days later that I wasn't done with it. Those scenes of that story kept coming back to my mind. I'd wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning with like a movie going through my mind. And I thought, okay, the only way I can get rid of this is to write about it. So at the end of 6 months, and at that time I still had a 40-hour a week job. So at the end of 6 months, I had written a 128,000 word novel. I was not intending to write that. I never had any interest in writing a novel, but there you go. That's still unpublished to this day. My wife still wants me to publish it at some point, and I may. But the book that I've released, which is my first debut published novel, promises to be a series of 7 books. So maybe at the end of those 7 books, I'll come back to this first novel.
Yeah, well, that's a lot of storytelling you have yet to do. What's the next one about?
The next one also takes place in the first century Nabataean kingdom. And it doesn't directly relate to this story, but a few of the characters from the first book will be appearing in the second book. It looks at the life of Queen Shekilot, who was a real-life queen. She was the second queen of King Harutot IV, who was, when you look around in Petra, a lot of the building projects that occurred were probably done during his reign. He was probably a very visionary guy and really did a lot of public works. But she is his second wife. And there are just a lot of really interesting things that I think are going on there. Another person that enters into it also comes out of the pages of the New Testament. There is a man named Shaul, who most people today would use the name Paul the Apostle. But there are very brief mentions in Paul's own writings about his time that he spent in the Nabataean kingdom. He uses the word Arabia, which is the term that Rome used for that area. So Paul says, right after I was converted, I went into Arabia or Nabatea for apparently it was a 2 to 3 year period. He doesn't say why. And then later in another one of his writings, he says, when I was in Damascus, I had to escape with my life because King Harutot had his main man in Damascus try and arrest me and haul me back to Petra. So there's a story to be told there. He doesn't say what the bad blood was between himself and Harutot, but Harutot, for some reason, wanted to get a hold of that man. So anyway, this is part of what's going on. It's mainly about Queen Shekilot's life. So a paradox about the Nabataeans is that they were apparently a highly literate culture, and yet they left no written records or archives. So the tack that I'm taking in the second novel is that I want to make this a first person, almost like a diary. I may end up doing it kind of a parallel thing, where one chapter I write Queen Shekilot's archives of the Nabataeans, like her historical record of the whole history of the Nabataeans, trying to reconstruct that. And then parallel chapters may be interleaved, where then she writes her just innermost personal secrets, kind of like a personal diary.
Well, it sounds like quite a chore ahead of you.
It will be.
But
it'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I really applaud you. I mean, that's why I like talking to historical novelists, because it's clear you've done so much research and so much work to fill in these gaps and bring these stories to the forefront. And, you know, history, like I said, I didn't know about. So congratulations on your debut novel, The Stonecutter.
Well, thank you.
And thank you, Brock, so much for joining me today.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.